Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for downloading our podcast this week. I'm John Montgomery. Before we get into the meat of it, I just want to mention our new term over at FX PhD that's beginning now. We've got 15 new courses, including a great miniatures and stop motion course, an After Effects design and compositing course led by Mark Christensen and feature film UI designer Mark Collar. We've got an advanced RED DOP course, as well as a Cinema 4D After Effects course done by Tim Clapham, and many more, including remakes of some of our introductory level courses. Check out fxphd.com for more information. Well, that's it for the FX PhD info. We appreciate your patience. I know a lot of you listen to these every week, but honestly, it's one of the things that allows us to keep offering FX Guide and the free content over at FX Guide, including these podcasts. So appreciate you sitting through that. Well, our podcast this week is regarding Motion Theory. It's a Venice-based firm that can follow a project from conception through to completion. They have on-staff writers, they have directors, they've got artists, CG artists, visual effects compositors. Really interesting company and really interesting philosophy. You may recognize their work from things such as the Weezer Pork and Beans video that's making its way on television and the web, kind of an homage to a lot of the superstars of YouTube, people like Ryan and Versus the Dorkman and so forth, as well as a really killer O2 spot that's been on the air, obviously, over in Europe. But Mike, Jeff, and I showed that at the Flame Masterclass this past year at NAB because Jeff was working on that spot. Really great work. This podcast is in two parts, and for the first part, Mike is going to be speaking with VFX supervisor Nick Losk. You talked to him recently, so why don't we go ahead and join that conversation now.
Thanks for that. And thanks, Nick, for taking time to talk to us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
So now, I'm really interested about Motion Theory as a company because it seems that you've really moved forward in being more than a production company and not a post house and an interesting kind of hybrid. And I'm wondering if you could just give me some idea as to the sort of the nature of the company. How do you explain it to your mum?
Oh, well, Motion Theory is what's classified as a micro studio. So with that said, I mean, it does everything that a full studio would do. I mean, it takes the concept, the pre-visualization, the actual shooting, the post, editorial. It basically takes a job from start to finish, which is kind of a new model with everything kind of being broken up and segmented. So it's a fantastic way to work because it allows us to oversee the whole process from start to finish and really maintain quality control all the way along. And it really helps minimize little things that might fall between the cracks when you're dealing with so many different vendors.
And how long has the company kind of been going?
I think this has been about 7.5 years now.
Wow. Was it always intended to work this way, or has it evolved over time?
No, you know, this was always Matt Collins' initial goal for this company, was to create a micro studio where everything could happen underneath one roof. And it's been in the last couple of years that we've really started to see these things just pick up to levels that have been very, very good for the company.
Now, I was lucky enough to see the O2 job that you guys did, and I'm going to get to that in a second, but I was trying to get to you to talk about the O2 job when the Pork and Beans film clip broke. And so I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that in starting, because that's a phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that thing has been picking up steam like crazy. I think in the first weekend alone, we had like something like 4.5 million hits on YouTube, which we were all pretty blown away with. Because it was one of those projects that was just kind of a labor of love. Everybody was just—it's just such a unique concept. I mean, to get all these YouTube celebrities in one place and then just mash them all together, and then incorporate the band. It was just one of those projects that was just fun, and to see it so well received was just such a nice bonus.
It must have been curious to have those internet celebrities even meet them each other, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, you know, I was actually kind of surprised. For the most part, those celebrities on YouTube have communicated with one another quite frequently because there seems to be somewhat of I wouldn't say a rivalry, but kind of like a friendly competition between them to see kind of who gets the most hits or whose videos are top rated. So it was surprising to see, but it was almost like a high school reunion where everybody was kind of coming back together in one place, and there was a lot of smiles, a lot of laughing. So that was very surprising to me.
Who actually tracked everybody down, and was that impossible, or did it turn out to be easier than you thought?
No, our producer on the job, Bernard, he tracked everybody down, but that was no easy task. There are definitely some celebs that we wanted to get that were not available, but I think they must have been running for like 2 weeks nonstop, just tracking people down, seeing availability, and I think those guys were on the phone just 24 hours a day.
Now, technically speaking, you're actually flew already to presumably Los Angeles to film that?
Yes, we shot everything in Hollywood.
And that was shot on high def, if I'm correct.
Yeah, you are correct. Yeah.
So the pipeline for integrating all that and the effects, there was presumably some compositing and some, you know, obvious more obvious effects, such as the gags in the actual clip.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that of those effects, Ryan and the Dorkman actually did their own lightsabers.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they actually volunteered for that. Like, that was one of those things that I was really excited about doing, because, I mean, you always dream about making lightsabers, especially in our field. But when they kind of prompted us and they said, you know, we really, really want to do this, and we thought it was just fitting for the whole tone of the video. I mean, this is the stuff that they did on their own when they posted these things to YouTube. So we're just like, yeah, you know, if you guys want to contribute, that'd be fantastic. And they did phenomenal work. Because after seeing those plates, I could tell that was just a hand roto all the way through.
Was there much stuff that ended up in the cutting room floor, or was it a fairly tight shoot to script?
No, I mean, there was a lot. We shot so much, and, I mean, with something like that, especially when you get that volume of people all in the same place, it's almost like every take you do is golden. So the editorial process on this job, I think, happened pretty much till the last couple days on the job. And just really finding and really dialing in on what clips we wanted to keep and which ones we unfortunately had to, you know, take out of the cut.
Yeah, I mean, clearly on some of those performers or some of those individuals, you could have spent a lot of screen time, and that's why they've obviously been so successful online in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just the level of professionalism with these people was really something to behold. I mean, there are certain people that, I mean, we deal with some high name actors, and these people were just in the same caliber. It was amazing. It's so easy to direct, and the results were phenomenal.
Well, having two daughters who were at that sort of preteen age, I think I've watched History of Dance about 400 times myself. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of those clips my mom sent me, and then when I told her that I met the History of Dance guy, that she really flipped out. She thought that was awesome.
I guess the only other thing I was going to ask you on that before we move off is that it seemed to me remarkable that you managed to recreate people's bedrooms, clothing, and everything. Had anyone changed that much that just, you know, getting them back to looking the same was difficult?
Yeah, you know, it was a challenge, but our art department, led by Terry Whitaker, who's phenomenal at set and stage design, she really knocked those out of the park. And then, you know, we did have a couple people that looked quite different, and we did a couple hair dyes and a couple haircuts, and just, you know, made sure that their wardrobe was as close to what they shot on the YouTube videos themselves.
Well, now, let's move on to something slightly more, more serious, but certainly perhaps more technically ambitious. It certainly appears so at first viewing, which is the O2 commercial that I initially mentioned I was terribly keen to talk to you about from
yeah.
The UK.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I saw that a little while ago, and I was just knocked out by both the art direction and the attention to detail and just the visual complexity of what seems to be virtually one long take. Can you tell us how you guys came to work on that UK production?
Yeah, you know, well, the agency approached us based on an old piece that we had done for ResFest, and this was at the beginning of Motion Theory's career. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to take that concept, the idea of one singular camera move where everything links up together, to help push this idea of connections, which was really important to their campaign. So, I mean, so what we did was we basically jumped on to Previz as quickly as possible. So, and we did that in conjunction with our storyboards and figuring out where our A, B, C, and D were. But you know, that type of job, it was so much time was spent previous, and we were very, very meticulous about making sure that things were as planned as possible when we went onto set. Because we knew that with the nature of the camera move, especially when we're shooting across four different locations, that any little bump can just trickle all the way down through the rest of the spot, which could cause a lot of work.
Now, you say four locations, but I understood that was pretty much six setups that were linking together. Is that because a couple were filmed together?
Well, let's see. Well, four locations, but six of which, six different camera setups, that is correct.
Right.
So, but we did still have to mesh a lot. And then for the giant crowd scene at the end, I think we ended up doing almost six takes of that we ended up stitching back together to create that just ocean of crowd.
And was that shot green screen, or did you just have a ton of roto?
That was a ton of roto. That was a challenge because we were so wide that we couldn't physically get the green screen in there, especially with all the smoke and the spotlights coming from the window. That was one of those shots that's really, really difficult to make a call on when you're supervising, because you're basically forced to pick the lesser of two evils. It's, do you want to recreate all that smoke and those volumetric lights in 3D, or do you want to spend the time rotoing the crowd and the people? And Motion Theory's philosophy is always, if you can get it in camera, get it in camera. And we felt that the smoke and the volumetric lights was definitely something that we wanted to be able to capture the real effect and not have to recreate it and have it kind of miss the mark.
Well, I mean, the compositing on that shot alone was terrific, and I believe your compositing team, I know it included Danny Jung, who we know to be a bit of a legend in the Flame community. Was it a Flame-based solution, or were you using After Effects or a combination?
No, it was Flame. The workflow for this was we laid out a lot of our shots in After Effects. So this is what we would consider part of the art direction stage. So the designers start kind of laying stuff out, playing with designs, choosing the location for our elements, and then that clip is then given to the compositor or the Flame compositors, who then recreate that using this this movie as a template, and then of course taking it to the next level.
So you mentioned the lack of green screen in that end shot, but for the earlier shots, because there's a lot of obviously integration of live action and CG, especially after the when you get past the water stuff into the street and the interiors. Was that green screen?
Let's see, into the street and in the interiors. So when we passed through the cafe, what we did was we screened off that dividing wall. So anything that you saw outside of that wall, we can mask out. But let's see, that was actually the only place where we actually used green screen.
Right.
The entire rest of the spot, we didn't use any screens except to take out just a tiny bit of background here and there, but nothing major where we were forced to recreate, like, giant, expansive sets. So what we did...
Sorry, go on.
No. So in the spot, we come out of the water, and what we did was we find a location where we break the surface of the water and we see all the frogs on the pond. So we found a small pond at a location out here in Los Angeles where we actually built that set, that cafe set, right next to the pond, so that we could get both these locations within one setup, which was something that seemed really challenging at the time, but in retrospect was really, really worthwhile.
And then the actual sort of populating of the environment, I mean, clearly there was someone having a whimsical time with teddy bears. How much was all of that in the original script, or how much was that your design team just having some fun?
No, the teddy bears were something that they were very confident on wanting just all the way through. We were a little surprised, but they love their teddy bears, and we were just happy to recreate that. It's always just a pleasure being able to do character work, especially on a project of that magnitude. And to be able to put so many of those teddy bears in there was fantastic. The frogs started as kind of a mutual kind of back and forth brainstorming, and we decided that frogs would be really nice because it's a nice element that can speak to the rhythm of the music with the croaking and the bouncing up and down. And we wanted the spot as a whole to really read as connections. And so we considered not just connections between the visuals, but connections between the visuals and the audio. And we felt that that was really good at branching all the way through. And that's the same reason why we have the dogs on the roof for the same kind of reason. Hmm. So this is one of the benefits of a place like Motion Theory is it's every job is much more of a collaboration than other studios might be. The one way I like to describe it to people who ask me is all ideas are acceptable here. It doesn't matter who they come from or where they come from. If that idea is the best, that's what we're going to do. And this is something that makes Motion Theory very unique as a studio. So the frogs is a very good example of that. It was just the perfect element for it, so we just went for it. And we were lucky enough to have a client that was very willing to let us kind of run with things that we felt would work well.
One of the few things that you didn't do is the final color grade, which I believe was done by Steve Rodriguez over at Riot. And Riot's mm-hmm. an excellent facility. But tell me, was that always the color palette, that kind of very rich? And how far was it off that when it went over to Riot?
The color was probably one of the things that we dialed the most. O2's color is blue. And they definitely wanted us to push that blue color as much as we could. But we took it to a point where we were happy with it, but then we kind of passed it out to Riot to do the rest of the job. But as far as I would say, I think we were pretty close before we handed it off to them.
So just some facts now. We discussed briefly the flame before. What was the tools that you were using for your 3D department?
The 3D department here is built off of a Maya backbone, in which we augment with programs like RealFlow, ZBrush, Houdini, and we do all our rendering through RenderMan.
Oh, really? It's a RenderMan pipe, so that's interesting.
Yeah, it seems, I don't know, RenderMan is one of those pieces of software that I think it gets a little overlooked in the industry, but it really produces some amazing quality renders, especially just straight out of the box with minor color tweaks. And when I was R&Ding kind of all the new renderers, that was one that just kind of leapt out at me right away. You do take a little bit of a hit in ray tracing, but I think it's really worthwhile, especially when you're doing color bleeding and things like that.
Yeah, and certainly they've been doing advances in RenderMan, well, constantly actually, but, even recently in terms of the ray tracing. I'm wondering, when you were looking at the project and trying to plot it out from your point of view, was there anything in particular that you kind of had as the, this one's going to be hard, or does it just, in other words, when you were yourself at the beginning of the project looking at it from your point of view, what was the areas that you really were focused on solving?
Well, you see, the first thing was just volume. The volume of assets on this job were astronomical, and in a 4-week post schedule, it was quite a challenge to overcome. But the second thing was the frogs, was trying to get that skin to feel as photographic as possible, and especially off the surface of the water. I mean, that posed a large challenge for us. But RenderMan really, really knocked it out of the park, especially with their subsurface scattering tools. I was really, really happy with the results we got on those things.
So in terms of the finishing out those statistics on the job, I mean, how long did you have from Woe to Go on the project, and was it hard working with a UK client?
Oh, no. I mean, the client was phenomenal. I mean, they were one of the easiest clients that I've ever worked with, and I really hope that I have the opportunity of working with them again. But from start to finish, I think it was just under 8 weeks of production. So we had about a week and a half to 2 weeks to prep. Then we shot for a week. Then we went to editorial for a week. And then we had about three and a half, four weeks of just heavy post work where we did nothing but 3D compositing and rendering.
Hmm. Great. Well, thank you for taking time to talk to us about that.
Thank you so much, Mike.
For part two of the podcast, we want to dive in a little bit more into detail about the actual process and the facility there at Motion Theory. So Mike Seymour spoke with Matt Winkle, who's the VFX producer.
So Matt, thanks for taking over. I just wanted to ask you about the size of the team on the O2 job.
Great. Well, overall on the post side, we had about 35 to 40 people.
And how many of those were sort of permanent in-house, and how many did you sort of wrangle in?
I'd say 2/3 are in-house staff, and the rest were, you know, hired freelancers with, specific disciplines that could add to the project, animators in specific.
How does the, I just want to, sort of curious from your point of view, how big is the sort of general pull there at Motion Theory, and to an extent, how much does a job like O2 kind of max out your place, or is it you're running that concurrently with a bunch of other jobs?
We were actually running it concurrently with some other jobs. Now, granted, you know, most of the facility was absorbed in the O2 project because not only were we doing the oxygen spot, we also had a second spot called houses.
Right.
So I'd say probably 80% of the facility was on the O2 project while we were either ramping up or winding down some other projects. So, fortunately, the timing worked in our favor.
And do you just keep a roster of freelancers? How did you to get the people that you needed for this job?
We are, constantly looking for the best talent out there. Motion Theory, prides themselves on not only providing a home for, talented artists of different disciplines, but a lot of it comes into, vibe of people. Matt and Javier, our owners and founders, try and run our facility much like a family in a house. So, people that will be good to their neighbors and work collaboratively with each other.
As you're running as a mini studio, I was just keen to kind of get a handle on how you load balance, because it struck me that for production companies, they can be, have not that many shoot days, and obviously posts can run for a long period on a single job. And I'm wondering how you sort of balance not having your front end of house effectively sitting around idle half the time.
Well, the good thing is between all our directors and the good luck that we've been having, we've been able to have many, many projects, so we're constantly staying busy. There hasn't been too much downtime in the several years that I've been here, so fortunately it keeps a live action team, sometimes we have one or two or even three at a time going to feed the work that our different directors are getting.
Does the sell into the client, is that difficult? Is this concept of a mini studio an easy sell in, or is it the clients get it straight away and it's not even a discussion point?
It really depends. I mean, I think for a lot of clients, it's very refreshing. They know the level of care that we put into our pitches, and part of that is is carried from concept to completion. So oftentimes, instead of dealing with one production company, one editorial house, and one post facility that all have different agendas, we're all teammates. So sometimes the old cliche of, they'll just fix it in post, we can, holler at our internal people or to put more of a positive spin on it, work with them earlier on the front end. So there's much, much more collaboration between all entities to, try and maximize the efficiencies and artistry as we go through our process.
So I guess I'm curious on set, is there, and I'll be honest, is there a bias towards, we'll just fix it in post because it's our guys and we know what we're doing, or is it more like we're going to take a lot more trouble on set because, God damn it, we don't want to have to fix it in post?
It oftentimes lies somewhere in the middle. The good thing is our directors are very post-savvy. Our visual effects supervisors and our directors are on set, so, instead of sometimes those disagreements of how long will it take the live action crew to revise something versus how big would the overage be in post, we can, all kind of discuss it and make quicker decisions that way. But, ultimately putting the job first rather than, individuals.
And on your sort of, new studio model, how is the producing handle? Is it basically a replica of the separate production company and separate post house with multiple directors and producers at both stages, or is it that you kind of streamline the process and there's more follow through from one to the other?
Again, it's both. I mean, a lot of times, we will have a live action producer that will hand it off to editorial and then hand it off to post based on our schedules. But more often than not lately, we are seeing jobs, all the way through from live action to the end of things.
Now, traditionally in America, the model has been that directors will shoot and hand over to the agency, and it's much more the agencies that see the project through post-production. Not the model always, and also certainly certain different parts of the world that's not the case, but in America it feels like it's the case. Is this model of your directors being so intimately involved right through editorial and post something that is of interest to the agencies, or do they find that a bit off-putting?
Oftentimes it is a bit awkward. You know, our job is to protect the visions of our directors. The nice thing is oftentimes agencies come to Motion Theory on a very early part of the conceptual process. So oftentimes we deliver the ideas together, and it allows them to, feel good about the decisions that are being made. The post-savvy A-list directors here in America, despite the fact that the model, typically pays for shoot days, at the end of the day, it's their name on the project, and the really good ones like to be involved from, storyboarding and previs all the way to, the final days of delivery.
Mm. And so, I guess moving forward, is it your plan to expand, or is it really that you feel like you've hit a good, because I mean, obviously you can take on big projects like this O2, there's no need to expand. What's the sort of feeling around the company?
Well, expand, I'm not sure if that's the proper word. We always strive to continue to grow. And Matt and Javier, set that vision for the rest of us.
Is it scalable? Is it possible you can add a roster of half a dozen more directors and scale accordingly? Or is it, you feel...
I think that's a question that's better suited for them. The nice thing is with the level of talent that we have internally here at Motion Theory, there are people that, can certainly step up and be our next generation of directors.
I mean, it's certainly, I think, from the outside looking in, is that Motion Theory is a fascinating model of a really successful creative process, one that doesn't seem to accept as the sort of level of compromise that other areas are forced to do. And I think a lot of people are both interested, of course, in the quality of the work you're doing, but also just in the model behind it. So we appreciate you taking time to talk to us about it.
Well, I appreciate your interest. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thanks, Matt, and also thanks, Nick, for taking the time to speak with us. We really appreciate it. I think it's a very interesting workflow and a very interesting company. I mean, I've always wanted to have more control over the creative concept as opposed to just getting the film and finishing myself. And I think as long as they continue to succeed and do really good creative work, this kind of facility or studio really makes a lot of sense to be able to control really strong creative. So it's really nice to see them making the most of it. As always, we love hearing from you. If you have any questions or comments, or let's say you just want to be a guest on one of the FX podcasts, drop us a line at podcasts@fxguide.com. And until next time, for the co-founders of FX Guide and FX PhD, Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.